You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Matthew Taylor, I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here for this evening's special event. Our discussion starts with a recognition that for many people and in many sectors, the nature of work and employment is shifting rapidly. It's an issue we've been exploring in our research here at the RSA. And of course, it's one that I'm more keenly aware of since I was asked to take over the chairmanship of the government's review of modern employment. So although I'm chairing tonight in my RSA capacity, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about work and the future of work. So we face, as we know, a situation of change, an uncertain economic future. But I think the one thing we can be pretty sure of is that in that future, we're going to need to develop new models of work, new forms of employment, new forms of organisation, the goal of which has to be that everyone has the opportunity to engage in productive work and work that has meaning and value. So with that kind of thought in mind, we've brought together an expert group of business leaders this evening who each have significant experience of thinking deeply about this question and of applying their own answers to it, to the culture, structure, and employment, employee engagement approaches of the companies they run. So we're delighted to welcome Stephen Bamfield, who's founding chair of the global executive search and leadership consultancy firm, Saxton Bamfield, which became employee-owned in 2014. Sir Charlie Mayfield, chairman of the John Lewis Partnership, the UK's largest employee-owned company. And Sasha Romanovic, CEO of the professional services firm Grant Thornton, which launched a new shared enterprise programme of employee engagement, responsibility and reward in 2015. So, Stephen, thank you for supporting the event.
Pleasure.
And so the least we could do, given that you are supporting the event and paying for the drinks afterwards, is to allow you...
You're very welcome.
You know, we'll do anything for the right price. Is to allow you to speak first. So could you start us off with your reflections on employee ownership and why... I mean, the reason for this event is that I met you and you were talking about what you'd done with such kind of zeal that it got me really excited about it. So tell us about why you did what you did... and what the benefits of that model are proving to be.
I'm delighted to do that. Thank you very much indeed. So this is going to be a personal story about our firm. When we get to questions, you know, we can get a little more philosophical perhaps. So we're an executive search firm. We're generalists. We work across lots of sectors from the HSBCs to the Church of England and other crazy organisations. We're 30 years old this year, and our mission statement has nothing in it about making a profit, which might give you a clue. We make a profit, otherwise we wouldn't still be here after 30 years. But our mission is to change the world by changing leaders in interesting and important organisations in our lives. And yes, there's a bit of a cop-out about what we each think are interesting and important. So we've grown to 80 people, and we'd seen how there were lots of different ownership models, but we decided that this was the right one for us after lots of research and, frankly, after lots of failures of looking at other things. We already had a very particular culture, and I think that's part of what this is about. We had a strong, supportive culture that had a slightly family feel. I'm a Benedictine and use the rule of St. Benedict as a bit of a management tool, so we already used words like community a lot, which I think Sasha's going to pick up on later. And we'd seen how not to do it. So we were minority owners of what became the number one search firm in New Zealand. It took 10 years to get to be number one in New Zealand. We sold it to one of the biggest firms in the world, and they destroyed it in 6 weeks. 6 weeks. That was a really interesting experience for me, and I thought, let's not do that again. So looking around at the different forms, and people like Charlie and John Lewis's were incredibly helpful about talking about it, I came to the view that, for me, employee ownership was a 21st century form of capitalism. We employ a lot of very bright, talented younger folk who arrive with a massive cynicism about most corporate life post-2008, post all our friends in the city taking all the money and running, and looking for meaning in their lives alongside work. So we decided that's what we do. So I guess for us it hasn't been a dramatic change overnight because we picked a culture that matched what we were. Huge change for me, and I think if there are any founders in the audience who want to talk about that, and I reflecting the other day with my board that I used to feel responsible to myself, and now I come in every day and I've got 83 people that I answer to. And I'm literally still in therapy about that, but it's working very well for us. Communication has been key for us, balancing the partner engagement with management's responsibility to still manage. And some of the employee-owned firms we looked at had got that terribly, terribly wrong, in my view. They'd confused ownership and management, and I think they are two very different things, which perhaps we can come back to. So for us, I'd say it's been an amazing journey. 2 years in, we're still learning. I was at our first annual general meeting, I gave an absolutely appallingly poor performance and explained to the partners why I'd done it. I mean, they'd had 2 years of me rabbiting on with zeal and enthusiasm before, but that was a real low. I just had our second AGM, and I scored slightly higher marks for that, so that was good. We learn as we go along. Engagement, enthusiasm in the business is off the scale. And if you want a real incentive, I have to tell you that in the first quarter after we became employee-owned, the cost base went down without management doing anything at all. So it was a really physical sign of everybody thinking, that's my money, and no, Mr. Next-Door Neighbour or Miss Next-Door Neighbour, you're not allowed to spend it without my approval. So, as Matthew points out, I have become a bit of a zealot. So if you want any zealot stuff, grab me later.
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Has this new way of working meant that issues of ethical practice have become more often raised?
We now have more structural furniture in the room where that gets looked at. I think we always were quite careful about that. But we now have a set of trustees who don't manage the managers but represent the ownership side. And we've given them, if you like, responsibility for being guardian of the values. So there are lots of occasions when the chairman of trustees, who is not me, is available to anybody in the firm who can go and say, I'm a bit concerned about this. So there's now a particular forum where values and ethics can get raised. We've been very lucky that it's hardly come up yet, but I'm sure it will, which is why you need the structure.
And the biggest challenge, apart from your performance at your annual meeting?
Yeah, we were trying to improve second time round. I think the biggest challenge has been actually managing the relationship between the board and the trustees when it's come to the end of year and how you exactly agree the partnership bonus. And there's not been any fisticuffs or anything, it's a new thing for us. And the board used to be able to meet and think, well, that's a terribly good idea, let's do that. Whereas now the board meets and thinks that's a terribly good idea, let's go and have a conversation with seven trustees, many of whom are still in their 20s and working in the firm. So it's a very interesting change in the dynamic and discussion about why you motivate people in certain ways financially, I would say.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure we'll come back to some of these themes in questions. Charlie, I think you're going to talk a bit about the kind of productivity angle of this. And I think I'm right in saying that in the autumn statement, the Chancellor's asking you to do some more thinking about productivity in general. So we've got you on the right day, I think.
Yeah. No, thanks, Matthew. And I have to start with, I'm delighted to be sitting next to Stephen, because not only has Saxton Bauerfeld done some really important work with us in terms of helping us with senior appointments, but also actually one of the reasons I'm at the John Lewis Partnership has actually got a lot to do with Anthony Saxton, who was the other half of Saxton Bamfield, who sadly died about a year ago, 2 years ago now, and about 17 years ago, or 18 years ago probably, Anthony took me for breakfast at the Connaught, which was his usual stalking ground, and about a year later I joined the partnership. So there we are. So anyway, good to be sitting next to Stephen, and indeed slightly the jam in the sandwich, actually, or whatever, the cheese in the sandwich or something, whichever analogy.
I think
you wish
jam
to
now means just about managing.
Yeah, that's probably that's probably exactly what I am, just about managing. So I'll be fairly brief, because I always, you know, I think it would be great to get to some questions, but just to try and link together some of these things. I'll start with the slightly more contextual views about productivity and why it's important, and then come on to talk about how I think employee ownership, and particularly in the context of our organisation, that can encourage and lead to an organisation approaching some of the challenges in a slightly different way, but very importantly, addressing them, things that I think are actually incredibly important to the success of the economy and indeed the prosperity of many people. But if I start with productivity, what is very clear to all of us is the world's changing at a really remarkable rate, and whether that's politically and what you just look around the place, you almost can't even stand still for a moment these days. But also, it's changing a lot socially, and there's quite a lot of discomfort with that. Somebody said to me just the other day that in a survey, 51% of people said that they felt that innovation was happening too quickly. Which I think is quite an interesting thing. It's of course absolutely not at all significant that 52% of people voted to leave the European Union, and those numbers are totally unrelated. But in some respects, I think there is some connection between those two things. Of course, different people, and then you overlay on top of that the future expectation, which came out very clearly in the autumn statement today, which is that we're entering a period where growth is likely to be slower. There would be debates about how slow, but slower, and markets more difficult, and conditions really quite challenging. So that's the sort of landscape that we're in, and I don't want to sort of bring a sort of bleak pall to this at all, but I think it's important that we recognise the context that we're having this conversation in, because we're far from powerless to respond to that. I think the danger is you must say that's that and therefore we can only do as well as we can do. I reject that totally. We're far from powerless to act. And in fact, we need to be even more vigorous in thinking about how we do so. And this brings me on to the work that I've been doing with a few other business leaders over the last 18 months or so, which is to look at this issue of productivity, because you probably know very well in the room, but basically since 2008, productivity in the UK has flatlined. And that's, by the way, very, very unusual. After recessions, you normally see productivity increasing quite rapidly. And it's very unusual that it's flatlined. I can go into lots more detail about the whys and the wherefores of it, but in the interest of time, I'll perhaps just move on. That is unusual, and it's a big problem. One of the issues is that productivity is a word that's used by economists, and it's places like the RSA talk about productivity, but it doesn't actually resonate with a lot of people as a particularly interesting concept. You talk to a lot of business leaders, they don't really talk about productivity. They think about things like paying wages and growing sales. But of course, productivity is one of the key determinants of our ability to raise wages and keep them there. It is a key determinant of the competitiveness of an economy. And when you go and analyse firm-level productivity, so you get beyond the sort of macro picture to a micro picture, what you find is that 2/3 of employees in the UK are working in firms whose productivity is below the level you would expect for a firm of that size in that sector, which is quite a startling thing. So if we're concerned about sluggish wage growth, that's a big part of the reason that we're seeing it. It has to be a big part of it. What we can also tell, though, is that if we can improve it, even only a fairly small amount, the potential value is enormous. If you took a company that's, say, at the 44th percentile in their sector, and they improved their productivity to the 54th percentile, so you don't have to go bottom quartile to top quartile, and you did that for about 70-odd percent of businesses in the UK, you'd unlock about more than £100 billion of additional GVA for the economy each and every year subsequently. So it's a huge, huge opportunity. When you dig into it a bit further, what you also find is that if you're looking for one of the key things that unlocks it, it is actually about management and about the quality of leadership. And again, there's some quite good work done by, amongst other places, the LSE on this, and Professor Van Rienen, which has mapped quality of management across different countries. And the slightly uncomfortable truth is that the UK has a longer tail of poorly managed businesses than most other economies. Yeah, so this is where some of the issue lies, and of course some of the opportunity. So we have to tackle this and get after it and improve that position. And I think this brings me on to ownership. So I'm absolutely not saying that employee ownership is a panacea. I've never felt that way. I think it's a very good way to own and run a company, but there are lots of good ways to own and run companies. But I do think that one of the characteristics of employee ownership, and I very much agree with what Stephen said about separating the management from the ownership, is the management feel quite accountable to the owners. I mean, that's what you were saying about your discomfort at your AGM. It's certainly what I feel in our business about some of the challenges that that we have to navigate. I feel very accountable to our people. And that does help you to think harder about whether you're doing a good job of being a manager and you're doing the things you should do about engaging people, explaining things simply and clearly, you know, helping people to understand the role that they can play in resolving issues, sometimes giving people difficult messages about the fact that they're in a position which is vulnerable and they need to change, hard though that is. As human beings, we always value what we know. And if I go back to, you know, one of the big other big contextual challenges, it is technology. You know, technology is going to change the workplace in a dramatic way, I think. 51% of people feel that innovation is moving too fast. It's going to be very hard to persuade, let's say, a 50-year-old truck driver who's got three kids and having to support elderly parents in social care that driverless lorries are a great idea. You know, it's hard to make that case. And yet it is people like that who will need to transition over the next 10 to 20 years from the jobs they're doing now into new and different jobs. And in an employee-owned business, I suppose what I would venture to suggest is that because the management's accountable to people like that, you pay more attention to thinking about, well, how on earth do I help that transition? And this is very current for me and indeed for the John Lewis Partnership, because, you know, while I'm very proud of a lot of the things we do, I'm incredibly aware of how fast the world's changing and how pressured it is. I'm also intensely aware of the kind of changes that we're going to need to make to our business. I'll give you another quick example, but we have about 17,000 people work on Waitrose checkouts. And if you think about the technology we all walk around with now, yeah, how many people are we going to need working in checkouts in 10 years' time? I don't know, honestly, but I do know that in the last year, the number of people using self-checkouts has gone from 17% to 25% in 1 year. And these are fairly newly introduced. So there's going to be enormous changes. And what we're going to need to do is to think about how do we create pathways for people to move from the roles they're doing today into more and more and more productive roles that are fully enabled by technology. And at the heart of that lie human beings who need to have the motivation, they need to have the instigation sometimes, they need to have the self-confidence to make some of the steps they have to have, and they need to have a supportive environment in which to make it. And at the heart of some of the productivity challenges we face lies, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And I suppose all I would finish by saying is that I do think that while employee-owned businesses certainly don't have all the answers, they're probably more likely than not, or more likely than some other forms of ownership, to think about some of those issues. It doesn't make them go away, but at least by applying yourself to them, there's the possibility that you can come up with solutions.
Thank you for that. One of the things that you said, Charlie, reminded me, we had a speaker here recently, a guy called Ryan Avent, who has written a book called The Wealth of Humans about technology and the impact on work. And he makes the point that we consider the Luddites to have been, you know, misguided, as well as ultimately unsuccessful. The point he makes is that actually the lives of working class people got worse for the 80 years after the Luddites. It was just that in those days there wasn't much democracy, and so therefore the ruling class was able to do what the ruling class did. Eventually, like people's lives got better, but, you know, imagine a politician who was to say to people now, just like you say with your lorry driver, you know, you want to support this technology and innovation because it's going to make life better for your great-grandchildren. And, you know, I mean, it's hard enough to get people to defer gratification for 6 weeks, let alone 60 years. So I'm really taken by your point, which is, in a sense, the critical thing about employee engagement is that people don't mind change if they're part of that change, but they don't like change if it's being done to them. Is that at the heart of it?
Well, that's yes. If you say to somebody, and we've unfortunately had to do this many times in our organisation, you know, is say, look, this part of the operation is no longer needed, or we can do it differently. And so the job you've been doing sometimes very well and working hard at and feeling valued for many years is no longer required. That's a really difficult conversation. Sometimes it means that people then leave our organisation, which is always sad, and we want to avoid it. But people who can then get over their initial disappointment or shock and then start realising that if they go and spend some time doing some things over here, or they're supported to go and explore different kind of roles over there, some of those people end up being the most engaged people we can possibly employ. And they suddenly realise that actually they've got more capability than they ever thought they had. And it's, you know, it can be a very positive thing. I think we can't afford to be naive here. And I'm not suggesting for one second that there's that sort of land of milk and honey is the outcome for everybody, because it isn't. And I think the scale of change we're going to see is that, sadly, you know, they're going to be winners and losers. And I think, truthfully, going forward in this next period, there's probably going to be more losers. The question is whether there are enough winners to keep the faith with, I mean, I'm talking about the broader, not just the JLJ-JLNS partnership, but to keep the faith with the broader way the economy is working. So this is it's a key issue. I mean, another quick stat, you know, people talk a lot about how people get into work, but 9 out of 10 of the people who will be in the workforce in 10 years' time are already working. And so the focus on people in work now and the way that they're going to progress and develop is hugely important. And I think it lies at the heart of making what there must be a transition. I'm certainly not of the view that we can eschew the benefits of technology. I think as an organisation, we're going to have to embrace them fully, otherwise we'll go out of business. But alongside embracing them fully, I think we do also need to pay more attention to how we're going to help people to transition from the jobs they're doing today to new and undoubtedly better jobs that can be created in the future.
Thank you. So, Sasha, you've been an outspoken advocate of kind of ethical business, of business driven by a different set of motives, a more rounded way of understanding the relationship of business to society. So how would you link this question about these questions about employee engagement and forms of governance and ownership to that broader mission you have for a different model of business?
Well, maybe I can take you all back. Imagine that you've now just rolled back to 2007 and it's a similarly sort of cold, dark November evening, a bit damp, except it's a little bit later at night. It's now 11 o'clock at night and I'm the fairly newly appointed head of people and culture for our firm, and post-layman's, we've lost a significant amount of transactional business, and instead of being set to do all sorts of wonderful development work with people, I'm now tasked with leading the firm's first firm-wide redundancy programme. And I think we all have those moments in our careers where they get you thinking there has to be a different way. Now, that moment, we actually engaged our people. The next day, we had an employee meeting with our employee representatives, and we had a choice as to whether to, you know, sweep it under the carpet and do what HR departments often do, which is sort of do it all in secret and suddenly call people into rooms and all this sort of thing, or do what we actually chose to do, which is actually share with our people, right, these are the challenges we're facing, these are the issues we need to address, we need your help in thinking through how we can address this. And actually, as a consequence, they came up with all sorts of creative ideas. People grouped together to say, well, actually, us group of managers only work for 4 people, and there's 5 of us, so let's all do 4 days a week. And we gave people freedom to think about different ways in which they could actually address the business issue. Now, that, for me, planted 2 fundamental seeds. One is the belief that, actually, we hire really smart, bright people, and if you actually create the space for them to contribute and to make a difference to our business, that would make us a better, stronger business. And the second one was that we needed to put ourselves in a position, rather than being buffeted by the winds of the economy, to think, well, what could we do to put ourselves in a position where we were actually at the heart of shaping it, not just for us, but also for the clients that we work with. So I thought it might be useful, because that's evolved into the model that we call shared enterprise. It comprises 3 different aspects, which is sharing ideas, sharing responsibility, and sharing reward. Sharing reward deliberately comes last because it's a consequence of the other two. And we deliberately, and probably unusually for a firm of accountants, didn't go down looking at structures and everything. We really wanted to focus on culturally what were the things that needed to shift and change for us to be successful as a business. So I thought maybe it was just worthwhile touching on really the sort of 3 different elements that have seemed to be pretty fundamental. One has been thinking about, well, what is almost the paradigm that we think about in terms of how the world currently works and how organisations currently work. And my observation, and I have to say this is sort of accumulated from lots of more brilliant people than me, but that we're still operating in very much this industrial model, where the prevailing paradigm, particularly in the city, is one that is governed by self-interest, by competition. You know, if I fight you, then I'll win and you'll lose and hurrah. And it was a hierarchical model which somehow believes that a small group of people at the top will be able to tell everyone else what to do, and that will make for a good, strong business. And I think that in this environment where things are changing so rapidly, you very quickly realise that that system fails. It's not set up to allow you to be agile and responsive to change, to think ahead, all of those sorts of things, because frankly, a few people at the top cannot really cope with processing what needs to happen. I think the best analogy for it is one that Frederick Laloux uses, which is saying, you know, we think about the world as a machine where there are levers to pull, but actually we're much more like a living system, like a forest. And imagine in a forest, if there's a tough winter coming, the tallest tree said, hang on a minute, you lot, hang on, we'll come up with a plan and we'll let you know what to do. It would be mental. Instead, you want to have a system where everybody is set to actually sense and respond, to empower, to react to what's happening, to make choices and decisions. So you move from this industrial model into a thinking, well, what if actually what we want to create is one where people are coming together around a shared purpose of what you want to achieve. For us, we've set that as shaping a vibrant economy, where instead of competition, it's a belief that collaboration, and actually collaboration beyond your business borders, is actually what really will create sustained success for the world in which we operate. And what if instead of hierarchy, it was saying, well, actually, it's agile networks of people connecting and making things happen is what's much more effective at making things happen. So that sort of is the philosophical sort of shift that I suppose sits behind what we're trying to achieve. It then sort of, looking at the people that we employ, as I said, you know, we employ smart, bright people. And I think we all know that when you look at what people are looking for in their work, that actually at their best, then actually they're in a place where they've got a real sense of meaning, that they can make a difference in what they can do. They've got that sense of autonomy, that they can make decisions, they're not waiting to be told. And actually they're invested in, so they can get great at what they're doing. And so we knew that in terms of our people, and we've done a lot around that. So for us, the challenge and where we are in our work in doing this, and we're really just a year into having implemented the whole programme of shared enterprise, is then thinking about, well, how do leaders need to be to create that environment? Because we're moving from a world where leaders are used to being the people who have the certainties, who have the answers, to being leaders who can actually create the possibilities. From leaders who just tell people what to do, to people who can set out, this is what we're trying to achieve, and help people find their connection and meaning to that. From a language that's all about disruption and destruction to a language that's about building people's confidence and construction. I hate the word disruption, because I think that actually when you think about how the brain works, you know, how we really thrive and succeed is when we get those positive messages to reinforce what we're doing well and we build on it. So those are the different aspects that we've been working on, and we really focused in the first year around sharing ideas and how do we get 4,500 people connecting with our purpose and starting to share ideas about how we can make that happen and starting to feel liberated to do that. Now, when we were preparing, I thought, you know, it's a tough journey, particularly when the world that you're in is one that is very much in this industrial model that, you know, you pull a lever, you get results, and if you're not getting results, then really everyone's instinct is to go straight to command and control. And I thought I'd share with you as my final bit a short piece of writing from a guy called Parker J. Palmer on communities, who is a Quaker who writes on this stuff. But I thought I'd share it with you because when it was shared with me, it suddenly made sense of the struggle that we were having as we were going through the journey. So I shall share it with you in the spirit that it may connect with some of you if you're on this journey already. So his words were, ironically, we often resist leaders who call upon our resourcefulness. We find it threatening when leaders say, I'm not going to tell you how to do this, let alone do it for you. But I'm going to create a space in which you can do it for yourselves. Why threatening? Because many of us have been persuaded by institutions ranging from educational to industrial to religious that we do not have the resources it takes to do things or even think things for ourselves. Many people have been convinced of their own inadequacy, and any leader who wants to invite them into a community of mutual resourcefulness must see this invisible wound and try to heal it. There is a name for what leaders experience during this prolonged period of patient waiting. It is called suffering. Suffering is what happens when you see the possibilities in others while they deny those same possibilities in themselves. Suffering is what happens when you hold in trust a space for community to emerge, but others lack the trust to enter the space and receive the gift. Suffering is what happens when you wait out their resistance, believing that people have more resources than they themselves believe they have. But leaders don't want to suffer. So we create and maintain institutional arrangements that protect leaders from suffering by assuming the worst of followers and encouraging leaders to dominate them by means of power. And I just thought I'd share those words because certainly what I've noticed is that as we create the space for people to share, one of the things I think we found most challenging of leaders in an organisation where people maybe haven't always got that trust, that they don't always immediately step forward. They're not sure that they're going to be heard. And they will test you and test you and test you to see if you really mean it. And it's really easy in that period where maybe you're not getting the results to think, oh, this doesn't work, I'm going to go back to telling them what to do. And that's exactly what they'll expect you to do. And I think that's probably a phase that we're in the journey of that sharing ideas, of continuing to build that trust, that connection to purpose, and helping people to really believe that, yes, they can make a difference. So.
And thank you for that. What are the particular challenges of trying to do this in the context of financial services, which is an incredibly regulated sector, and where, as Grant's not an experience through the BHS thing, you know, you can end up with really big reputational issues because you're associated with something which people strongly disapprove of. So, how do you balance that, giving people autonomy, with those kind of big capital R risk issues?
I think the key thing that we did was actually spent some time really refreshing and revising actually our code of conduct and getting people to think about, if no one's in the room watching you and your mother was sitting over your shoulder, what choice would you make? Would it be a decision you'd be proud to tell your friends and family about? And I think a lot of it is creating that open dialogue around sometimes choices that aren't, they're not binary. It's an interesting one for us as a financial services institution. Often where we can add most value is to where a business is in distress or it's in a situation where it needs to do significant work on itself to move forward. And so, should we work with businesses that need that support? Yes, because actually those are the ones that absolutely need it. Equally, are there businesses that you feel you're not comfortable working with, that needs to be something that is actually really out there as a discussion and a debate rather than it being, because I think the challenge with so many of these things, there isn't a black and white, there isn't a right or wrong, there are these shades of grey, and often those will change as you actually go through working with a business and situations change. So creating that really open environment where people feel they can talk about things, they can challenge things, is, I think, critical to that actually wider reputation management of a business. And it's not easy. And, as a business, you won't always get it right. And I think as a business, for your people in it, if you're saying we trust you to step forward, how you deal with it when things don't work out will give them a very clear idea of whether you really mean it's okay to try things out and experiment or not. So, it's a lot of complicated things to wrestle with, I think.
We've had speak here, we've had Frederick Laloux, but we also had Jos de Blok, who, of course, is famously set up a firm which does most domiciliary care in the Netherlands without any apparent hierarchy, and where he manages, according to himself, he manages by blog. A couple of things that he said which resonate with what you said was... he said, someone said, why did you do this? Why did you strip out all the bureaucracy and all this stuff? And he said, look, people have only got a certain capacity for complexity, and I want them to use all that capacity in treating people and supporting people, not in dealing with the organisation. And I thought of most people's experience of working in the NHS and other public services, and it's a kind of stark point. But the other point he made, which I guess is probably not one you can fully apply in your highly regulated sector, is he said to his nurses, if someone said in the meeting, what about rules and regulations? And he said, I said to my nurses, if any rule and regulation gets in the way of you caring for people, you can ignore it. So you probably can't quite apply that. Can I ask you all a question before we open up to the room? What about customers, clients in this picture?
I mean, I think it's probably going to be quite different from your perspective, right? Because the relationship you have is a more transactional relationship with your customers, I guess. But I'm interested in the way in which the relationship that exists amongst employees and between employees and managers impacts the relationship with the worker has with the customers and clients. Do you want to go first on that session?
Yeah, I mean, because I think that goes to the fundamental heart, I guess, when you start putting a purpose at the heart of your business, that then every, you know, our aspiration is that every time anyone in an organisation is doing something, they're saying, well, actually, if we're about shaping a vibrant economy and this particular client I know is a dynamic organisation exporting, how does our advice help them to achieve that in a long-term sustainable way? So that's the connection that we're wanting to make for people. And I think it also underpins a fundamental shift in the engagement that we want our people to have with clients, to move from being the expert that, you know, you come in with a question and I say, right, here's the answer and da-da, it's done, to actually having much more of an inquiry as to, well, let's really step back and look at the context in which you're operating, what's important, and to be able to build value in a much longer term perspective. And that could be through making, you know, it could be that through a conversation, the most value we make is actually identifying that you meeting with you is actually, you know, really valuable for our business, and we will just make that connection. Sometimes that will be the most important thing we can do for a client in a year. And so getting our people to think in a very different relationship way versus a transactional way against clients is quite fundamental to, we think, in delivering our purpose.
I think I remember you telling me that one of the things you're doing in some of your stores is to try to move it from just being about buying stuff to being about an experience. So is that challenge that you're setting for staff, which is that they are developing a more relational attitude to the people who walk in, is that linked to the nature of the company?
Yes, it is. But it's a bigger thing than that. I mean, customers write to me when they're either really cross that we've done something wrong, or they're completely delighted that we've done something right, and there's not much in between. And unfortunately, I get more letters of the previous kind than the latter. But when I get the latter ones, invariably, it's not that the pot or the pan that we sold them was so wonderful that it exceeded all their expectations to the point that the sun came out and forever shone on their lives. It's always about one of our people and what they've done. Sometimes it's about when somebody put something right, actually, but that's gone wrong previously. But it's always about our people. So there's no question that that is the cornerstone of the relationship between us and our customers. It's not to say that product's unimportant. Of course, it's hugely important. It's like the medium that the business wouldn't exist without the product. If Waitrose didn't sell food, it wouldn't really be Waitrose. If John Lewis didn't sell beds and things, it wouldn't be John Lewis. But the products provide the medium within which the partners then bring it all to life. And in some respects, I think as people look at the way the world is developing, the way retail is developing with Amazon and technology, it's becoming a much more technologically intensive industry. You might think that the role of the person was becoming less important. And for some businesses, truthfully, it will become less important. But those businesses are effectively taking a strategic decision to become utterly transactional. And, you know, the thing about being a totally transactional business is you sort of have to be the lowest cost operator in order for that to be a good, a viable long-term strategy. And while we have many good things about our business, we will never be the lowest cost operator. And so we have to take a very clear and different route, which is towards working out how do we get more value from our people? How do we connect our best people with the customers who will value their service and what they can bring to it more and more and more? And that is absolutely at the heart of how we can compete and succeed in the long run. So it's really about becoming not so transactional and much more relational. It's not just about experience in the shops. That's part of it, true. But it actually goes much, much further than that.
So in a way, there's a link here between people who feel respected as employees are more likely to show respect towards customers and,
Yeah, but it's also about enabling them. So I'm going to give you another example. I was in our Watford shop the other day, about 6 months ago, and I met a section manager called Jordan. And she told me she'd just transferred from Oxford Street. And I always, when that happens, I always say, so tell me about the difference, because it's always interesting to hear. She said, well, we know all our customers. I said, that's really interesting. Tell me more. So she said, well, I work in women's wear. In Oxford Street, there are so many people coming past that every now and again we'll see the same person, but we don't really know who they are. I mean, it's just a wall of customers on a good day. In Watford, we see the same people every week. So I said, what you mean is you recognise them, but you don't know that's Mrs. Smith. And yet we do know that's Mrs. Smith in Victoria, in the depths of our data, because we're harvesting that in extraordinarily efficiently. And so the great opportunity for us is to figure out, so how do we take that knowledge and put it into Jordan's head? That's where it's at. And then encourage and empower her to use her judgment to put that to good use. And if you did that well, I've no doubt, if she knew that Mrs. Smith bought a Reese skirt the other day and she's had a look at Jigsaw before, wouldn't it be great if Jordan was able to go and say, hi, Mrs. Smith, it's wonderful to see you again. Did you know we've just had a whole load of new Reese skirts in? Come and have a look. It would be. There's so much potential for us to do that.
Stephen, has it affected you in the sense of, do you ever get people who come in and say, look, what we need is a new boss and that's going to change everything? And you think, no, it's not. actually, there's a lot that's wrong with this organisation that no new boss is.
My client organisations.
Yes.
Yes, then I look very wise and say, well, it's all about leadership teams.
You just want more business when you
But I mean, to answer your question about the perspective of clients, I mean, we ask them, are they really like what we've done? And to pick up on what Charlie's saying, I mean, one of the things I do, holding my breath slightly, is take any client back of house and just invite them to talk to anybody about what it feels like to be a partner. And I have to say our receptionist is much more compelling about it even than I am. And we've seen that clients love that and love that richness of experience. And I think they get better work from, laughingly, our junior folk, if I can say that, we don't really have levels, because those people know them. I think we're seeing more of that. The other thing they like is that in the search profession, a lot of people flip from firm to firm, and they feel we're going to be here forever now. So they know where to find us if it doesn't work out. So I think that continuity has worked very well for us.
Maybe you should get the receptionist to do the presentation at the annual meeting.
Absolutely.
definitely. Let's take a few comments from around the room.
I'm Margaret McCabe, the CEO and founder of a social enterprise called DebateMate. We've just been invited to accept membership of the Social Stock Exchange. The Social Stock Exchange measures your social impact before they measure your business, and then the investors will want a social return on investment and a financial return on investment. So if there is a situation, and this is becoming a very, very popular way of doing business, profit margins are very are big in the businesses that are part of the Social Stock Exchange. But basically, we personally as a business grow human capital, and within that we find the leadership potential in everyone that we work with, and we have a website so everyone can look at that. But basically, I would suggest that if you're looking for your lorry driver who's got no purpose left in life, as a business, I would suggest that now the way of going about that is looking at turning that negative into a positive. How do you turn the social impact of him being made redundant, having elderly parents to look after, how do you turn that to a positive impact as a business and as an organisation? And there is a lot of tax benefits, a lot of financial benefits, and a lot of thinking out of the box ways of doing that now.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. My name is Charlotte Deer. I've been involved in cultural change from a paternalistic, really hierarchical family business where the founder is no longer involved to a very much more peer-based culture, or trying to. So the part of the comments that have most resonated with me is the suffering of managers, the refraining from stepping in. So I'd love to hear more about the development that you've been involved with that's enabled both the individuals to find their voice and the managers to continue to refrain to step in, because I think that's just crucial and it's so difficult. So any more about that would be really interesting.
I mean, I've seen quite a lot of research that says that the problem is middle managers and the degree to which middle managers feel empowered in these processes of change. Interesting.
Right. You gave the example of the lorry driver, and that's a very easy example. He will be replaced eventually by a driverless cab. There's no doubt about that. But also, artificial intelligence won't stop there, and it might well be that you guys might be replaced as well. And I just wonder, what world is it? What the assumption is, that world of change is always going to impact upon other people, and they're the ones that are going to be deprived of a livelihood. But I just wonder what happens when artificial intelligence can perform better than you guys can do leading companies. So that's something I'd like to throw at you.
Thank you very much. They're not easy, these questions, are they? take the guy there. Thank you.
My name's Kenny. I'm from Clearview Research. My question is basically looking at the fact that you mentioned that, well, looking at the future of employment, a lot of people that will be employed, nine out of ten of them are already working. So that basically means my generation is more screwed than people already think we are. But then I think also on the flip side is that a lot of big companies such as probably your own, coming back to this question, there's a massive threat that you won't exist. Forget about AI, but the fact of the conversation we're having today, a lot of these companies, the culture is so... That's just so bad at the moment that actually a lot of those people will look for places where it is ethical, there is purpose, and actually you can make an impact and actually be financially remunerated. So I just wonder, how does that threat bother you, if not you, but the actual sector? Because I feel young people are very productive, and actually the employee ownership and stuff is great. However, it's only really startups and new companies that are doing that. And you guys are so rare. So I just wonder how a lot of the big business you're talking about, of course, the economy is going to be messed up if they don't change the way they just keep giving people dead wages, dead pay, make people feel down. And forgetting about lorry drivers or anything like that. People just, where's the empathy or care for staff anyway?
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. 20 years at BP, and I've been working now with the Global Impact Hub Network. So I've been following a lot about responsible business. And the thing, and very much linking to your point, it's the same fantastic thought leaders. I see Sasha over again. I see Estelle from Viola and John Lewis, Unilever. And it really concerns me about how many other businesses they talk about. They're catching on. They need to find a purpose. But that already to me isn't authentic. I need to get a purpose so I can recruit some millennials. So it just doesn't work. So for me, the big question is if we're going to get a success out of the tech changes and that money can be ploughed into communities and businesses doing good, what do we do about all the very large companies who I think are really struggling? Do we let them fail, or how do we engage them? And that's maybe a question about government regulation too. Where can regulation step in a positive way around tax or whatever to actually try and build a success story versus a number of companies, okay, but not enough companies?
I think we've got time to take just one or these two here. So one in the corner and then the gentleman, I think it's a blue shirt.
Hi, I'm Benedict Orso from DebateMate. I'm going to try and make this as unloaded a question as possible.
And short.
Yeah. To what extent is automation inexorable in terms of, it's a trend, obviously, but I do also think that it's incumbent on business leaders like yourselves, not just to kind of ride the wave of automation, but to have a responsible attitude towards it. I wonder how many people don't work the service line at Waitrose because of automation, and for a company to have at its heart its people, but to have to let people go and they have to find another place to work or retrain or go on income support for the benefit of maybe 0.001% for each of the other partners within the partnership. I wonder whether it is inexorable or to what extent people like yourselves and others can put the brakes on it or at least manage it responsibly.
Great. Gentleman there.
Thank you. Darius and Noel, thanks so much for your contributions. I'm interested in your vision of where we're heading in the sense of the dividend, this productivity dividend. How do we share it between us all? And is the vision that we're all going to be working? Are we going to get to a point where we're so productive that actually the lorry driver doesn't need to be working anymore?
Great. Well, we've gone very wide, which is typical. I mean, one comment I'd make, I ask the panel. Panel, just choose two or three of those things to respond to in a couple of minutes before we close. But one point I would make is that we've had a number of speakers here, like Dennis Sarbis from Google DeepMind and Ryan Avant, I meant to mention, a whole number of them, talking about technology, and all of them have agreed, whatever their political position, that unless we can crack the issue of distribution, then technological innovation is going to lead to kind of further huge problems with social legitimacy, which is, I guess, the point Charlie was making. Somehow we've got to make this work for all people, or at least most people, or else people are going to simply say no to progress, and then we don't know quite what happens there. So, Charlie, why don't you start? Just pick a couple, and then Sasha, and then Steve.
First of all, I thought what Sasha read out is really fascinating, and so somebody did ask the question, does it resonate? Absolutely, it resonates. And I think that there is a... We shouldn't we shouldn't gloss over in the slightest that the prevailing style of management, what's been trained into people, how people tend to adopt, is not what you've described. Furthermore, I think that most businesses operate on the assumption that they're, or the senior management operate on the assumption that they can anticipate the future, plan for it, create a plan, tell everyone about it, and their job is basically to get on and do it, which is where I think some of the rot sets in. It's almost that assumption that has to be challenged, and instead adopting something which is about a bit more agility, frankly. And there's enough evidence now to say you can't plan for just about anything because it's happening so quickly. So I very much agree with that. I think the I'll try and link together a few things. I mean, first of all, I think it was, I didn't catch the name actually, but the dystopian view about, you know, whether all jobs disappear, whether we all go. I personally think that while technology will replace a lot of jobs, I also think it's almost certain to create quite a lot of jobs as well. I think the bit I worry about is the in between where we are now and when we get to those happy times, where it could be difficult. But I don't think they'll disappear altogether. I totally agree with the point that was made by Benedict, I think, about automation and not just accepting it. Absolutely. And we're definitely not just accepting this and saying, oh dear, you know, well, that's the greater good is served and too bad if there are a lot of casualties. But equally, you know, you can't just sort of carry on and ignore it. What you have to do is grapple with it in a very purposeful way. So one of the three objectives I'm setting, all the challenges I'm really making for the organisation, is to say, look, we've got to create better jobs for better performing people on better pay. And that has to be our mission. Now, the truth is we'll probably have fewer, but we've got to create better. And we've got to make that convincing and evident so people can see it and understand that that's what they're moving towards. And then when you start getting into that, there's actually a lot you can do to do it. And it's not rocket science. It's about very behavioural. It's about giving people the opportunity to go and try things, do things, realise they're more capable than they might have allowed. People self-edit hugely. So that's a big, big, big opportunity. I think it was Kenny or Kelly, I didn't quite catch it, about you said, how threatened you feel? Very. I, on the one hand, you know, look, I'm proud of our organisation. I think we do great stuff. We've got fantastic people. But I spend a lot of my time challenging and saying, look, we need to realise that the way the world's changing is greater and bigger than we are, and therefore our response has to move at a much faster rate than actually it is, truthfully. And you know, alongside better jobs and better performing partners and better pay, we have to look at what is the proposition to the customer. This goes back to Matthew's original question. Retailing is an industry which is almost certain to see lower returns going forward. Almost certain. So we have to define a future which is not just about a transaction between a faceless corporation and a customer, but something where we add much more value that the customer values and is prepared to pay for. And again, when you get into that kind of thinking, I feel hugely optimistic about all the opportunities and the capabilities we've got. And we can focus them much better than we do today and use them better to do much more. And with that, we'll create fantastic jobs for people of all ages, frankly. But it's a bigger mindset shift than comes naturally or normally.
Thank you.
Let me pick up on, I think, three different aspects. The one in terms of the change, a lot of the work that we've been doing with our people is actually embedding a coaching culture. And I don't know how many people in the room are qualified coaches. Hands up, yeah, so quite a few of you. I don't know if any of you had the same realisation that I had when I started my coaching programme of realising, oh my Lord, this is why it's been so tough. I've been trying to do all the thinking for people for all these years and suddenly realising, oh, this is great, I can just ask them questions, they know the answers and I can just create the space for them to get on with it. And so, you know, I think our people who've been through the coaching programme and have gone through that personal development are getting it a lot quicker than those who haven't. And, you know, part of the challenge is, you know, there are some people who are really open to trying that and some people who are like, you know, they've made their lives on being the expert who has all the answers, and it's deeply threatening asking them to do something different. And so some of it is actually just creating the space for people to actually go at their own pace. And sometimes people will just need to see that it works before they're prepared to leap. Others are prepared to leap because they believe there is something different and they've got that frustration that drives them. So I think that's something I've had to really learn over the last year, is that patience. And also thinking about how you can model it as a leader. And, you know, my first year of CEO, Some of my partners think I've been brilliant. Some, I'm sure, think I've been hopeless because they're expecting me to, you know, some are expecting me to have all the answers and to tell them what to do. And I'm deliberately holding back, to the point that a lot of them are deeply frustrated with it. But that is very deliberate because actually it's only at that point, it's like, well, she's not going to do it. I'm going to have to step forward. And then you actually get the shift that you want in an organisation. But that's, you know, it feels quite horrid at times, and I question myself sometimes, oh, is this what a CEO is meant to do? Am I doing it right? So that's that one. I think the other thing I was going to pick up was in terms of the trade-offs. I think, is it Benedict? Yeah. And I think that there is this real moral and ethical debate that actually we need to have in broader society about some of the choices that we're making societally. Because we all know that actually people, you know, when people are out of employment, whether that's actually paid employment or voluntary employment, when they're out of that, then actually the impact in terms of their mental health and well-being is really quite phenomenal. And we've just launched our Vibrant Economy Index, which was actually looking at, you know, what are the measures in society that actually show that there is a vibrant economy where people are able to thrive. And surprise, surprise, is that if you have an economy where pound notes, it looks like it's thriving, but actually you haven't addressed those things such as distribution of wealth, such as well-being, all of those sorts of things, you actually don't have an economy that is working to its fullest extent. And I think that we've got a very binary media at the moment, very binary, that gives you an idea that it's a yes or a no, it's an either and an or, when I think we all know there are trade-offs. And we need to be in a position, and I think forums like this are great, to actually have a really responsible conversation about it and not collude with people thinking that it's easy, because it's not. And we need a lot more people involved in the discussion. And the final bit in terms of, you know, leaders out there speaking, you know, James is sitting in the front row. I was listening to him speaking last night from Timpsons. There are, I think, a lot of business leaders doing it. When I started talking about it, what was wonderful was it was like suddenly this door appeared in a wall that I thought was a flat wall, and I stepped into this room, and there are loads of businesses that are actually thinking in a fundamentally different way that we can impact society and be successful businesses, and the two have to go hand in hand together. And I think, you know, one of my missions is that what I learned was that hearing other people talking about it made me think I wasn't mad, it was okay. And that's why I try to get out and about and talk about it to inspire others. And I know that these guys are the same just from the time I've spent with them. So,
very interesting. You get it down at the Autumn Statement, a news programme saying, now we're going to hear from business. And what you get is an incredibly narrow account of whether, you know, and that isn't the voice of business, of course. Steve, last but not least.
Yeah, well, thank you. I think one of the things, and sort of underlying also a number of the questions that were asked, I think one of the things we have to realise is that businesses fail. And it's a mistake to expect them not to. Let's not go around the room and count how many people have a copy of McKinsey's wonderful work, Built to Last, on their bookshelves. But many of us rushed out and bought it, and it was a historic survey of the greatest American businesses that had lasted 100 years and told you how to become one of those. And 15 years later, they had to issue another one called Good to Great because half of the first lot had gone bust.
But not McKinsey,
because they changed the view. Exactly. And that's not an anti-McKinsey point, but it is a point that we should expect human changes, societal changes, technology changes to produce some businesses that disappear. Some businesses will change. I mean, I always loved, you know, the late lamented Nokia giving us all our handsets around the world, whereas actually they were Finland's first and best waterproof boot producers. But somewhere along the way, somebody said, the market's going to hell in waterproof boots. Why don't we make handsets? And they did it very successfully for a long time. And for me, I want to draw, I'm not going back to the lorry driver, but I want to draw a distinction between, I think there is a role for top leaders not being replaced by AI that's about having sufficient paranoia and looking over the horizon. And I think that's one of the things that I think all of us do, is worry about, you know, what's happening 5-10 years down the road. I'll leave you with the optimistic thought that I think if you just trust the people who work with you and ask them what they think about what's going on, you get fantastic feedback. And we've got a number of people in my firm who are slightly over crazy cyclists, so we all love Dave Brailsford. So we had a marginal gains session recently. You know, what were the marginal gains that make our business better? And we've got 65 of them, not coming from the board, not coming from me and the top management, but coming from everybody saying, well, since you ask, why don't we do this? And they're all terrific ideas. So expect destruction, but be optimistic.
Great, Stephen. Thank you very much. I fear the most tweetable line of the evening is from the person who said, we must have a purpose, we need some millennials. But nevertheless, that isn't a reflection of the quality of the contributions that we've had overall. Some fantastic questions. Thank you for those. It's been a really interesting conversation. I think everyone's going to leave with lots of thoughts rolling around their heads. Thanks to the beneficence of Saxton Bamford, it must have been a collective decision you made to pay for the cheese to pay for the cheese straws and wine. And we're very grateful to everyone who works with you for doing that. It just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking our great speakers tonight, Stephen, Charlie and Sasha.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.